Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this session, Fellowship of the Aura Ring Through Cancer Treatment and Back Again. My name's Nicolette Rubenstein. I am thrilled to be chairing this session. Firstly, I'm really excited that we as the profession are getting involved in this type of analysis. Secondly, I believe that I am well qualified to chair this session as an actuary who owns an aura ring and has had breast cancer. So I think I'm doing pretty well. Our speakers today, we've got two speakers, Amanda Aitken and Matt Noyce. Amanda is probably well known to many of you because she's a member of the Actuaries Institute education team. She's currently a member of the Data Science Practice Committee and the Data Science Education Faculty. And Matt is an actuary with more than 30 years experience across life insurance, reinsurance and superannuation across multiple countries. His previous roles include Chief Pricing Actuary for Swiss Re and Chief Pricing Officer for CommInsure. 5 years ago, he founded MNC Actuaries, who happens to be a sponsor of our conference as well, a firm of 20 actuaries and data scientists. I should note that this is a bit of a follow-on session from a session last year called Apple versus Actuary, which was a fascinating session. I am tipping this to be the most exciting session of the conference. let's see how we go. In terms of the format, we've got 45 minutes, 30 minutes of presentation time. Then we've got time for questions. In terms of the format, Amanda and Matt are going to do a bit of a tag team. So Amanda's going to share her personal experience at each stage of the cancer journey. And then Matt is going to dive into the Aura Ring results at each stage. So in terms of questions, please go onto the Q&A icon on the Summit HQ app. We'll also take questions from the floor as well. Amanda said, you know, she's very open and comfortable with personal questions as well. So go for it. and just want to acknowledge as well that this is one person's cancer journey. Obviously, probably in this room, other people have gone through something similar, but it's obviously a very individual experience. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Amanda. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicolette. I'm betting that most of you in the room, if not everyone, has had at least one event in their life where they can remember exactly where they were when it happened. For me, one of these events was in 2021 when the mighty Melbourne Demons won the grand final and I was at home watching with my family on the couch while they played in WA because of annoying COVID restrictions. Another such event in my life, and apologies, this is going to take a slightly darker turn, is the day that I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was at the clinic of Breast Screen Victoria, and a breast surgeon who was giving me the news told me two things that will stick with me forever. The first was that I had a small but aggressive, which means fast-growing tumour. And the second is that my GP, the wonderful Sara Hassan, who had sent me for a routine mammogram a few weeks previously, had very likely saved my life. Because if they'd found the cancer any later, I very likely may not have been standing here today. Wasn't sure if I would get emotional or not, today or not, but maybe there is a little bit there. So immediately after finding out that I had cancer, everything happened in what felt like triple speed. In the next week, I had a PET scan, a CT scan, a heart check, an MRI, several doctor's visits, blood tests, a chemo education session. It was really full on. And then my chemotherapy started 1 week later. So, yep, bang, you go from thinking you're fine to having chemotherapy. Throughout this journey, I had this little device on my finger called an aura ring. Does anyone here own an aura ring, wear an aura ring? Yes, I've got one other aura ring obsessed person. Yay. For those that don't know what an aura ring is, it stays on my finger at all times unless I'm charging it. And it tracks a range of different stats for me. So it tracks how many steps I take each day, what my heart rate is doing. It's probably quite high at the moment. It tracks my body temperature and my sleep and tells me how good my sleep was each night. So while I was going through chemo and feeling pretty rotten at some stages, I developed what you would say is a morbid curiosity about what the Oura Ring had to say about the impact of chemo on my body. So I contacted Matt and his amazing team of data scientists and said, would you be interested in analysing these stats as a follow-on from last year's summit session? And that has led us to be here today to share with you my story of cancer, both through the Oura Ring stats, but I'll also share with you some of my personal reflections. Matt, maybe you can start by sharing why aura-obsessed people like me and Jazz are interested in our sleep and trying to predict how good our sleep will be and also trying to improve our sleep.
Thanks, Amanda. Oh, is this on? Yes, it is. Wow, that's a powerful opening, isn't it? Makes you think. So, as Amanda says, why do we analyze sleep in the first place? Well, sleep is incredibly vital to our health. It affects our emotional regulation, our mood. It affects our brain function, muscle repair, all kinds of things, and our immunity. And I don't know if you're one of the people that tracks their things like, you know, diet and health and exercise, all those sort of things. But normally, if something is off in your life, then I think your sleep will suffer. So I think it's a very good thing to measure. And also, it does link to the study we did last year. And Amanda was a participant in that Aptool versus Actuary study, and we had all of her health data anyway from that presentation. And of course, we didn't know that something awful was going to happen, but it made sense to follow on from that. So, quick recap on the previous study. So, Apple versus Actuary looked at a whole range of devices, wearable devices and information that is measured. And we built a sleep efficiency model, which wasn't an amazingly good fit. And we had, you know, a lot of different devices, Oura Rings and Apple Watches and all kinds of things measuring different data and proprietary calculations differently. So we thought, well, why don't we use this to improve the sleep efficiency model this time around? And crucially, we wanted to look at Amanda's health stats during the various time periods and see if we could detect any changes prior to and during her cancer treatment as well. So that was, you know, obviously the big point of the study, because Amanda approached us and we were obviously very glad to do that. I will say that there's not much in terms of analysis and research on this. There's loads of stuff, you know, after people have had cancer and during treatment, but there's actually very little pre-diagnosis, because of course, you know, we don't know which of us is going to be impacted by cancer. So this is something of a new study, and we didn't know quite what we were going to find. So quick overview of the analysis framework. So we've divided this into different periods. We start with a 3-year baseline period, which covers Amanda's daily life when she was out and about and didn't have cancer to worry about. And then we have a pre-diagnosis period, which is around a 4-month period ending April 2024. And then we look at what happened during her chemotherapy and treatment phase. And that was a 6-month period. And then chemo is about 4 months, post-chemo is about 6 months, and then we revisit the sleep efficiency predictor model. So that is the plan for this session, and we'll pass over to Amanda now to talk about, her life before the diagnosis.
Yeah, so in the 3 months leading up to December 2023, so that's well before I knew that I had cancer, I think I was generally pretty fit and healthy. I had a really good exercise program. I liked running, riding my bike, swimming. I did weights in our gym at home. And I also had exercise that I liked to participate in for my mind. So I liked doing yoga. I have a regular meditation practice. And I've been on a vegan diet for the last 10 years. So, I generally felt like I was pretty healthy. There was one interruption, a notable interruption in the middle of this 3-year period. In 2022, I had a hamstring injury and then a cortisone injection for that, which meant that I couldn't exercise for a month or two. And about the same time, I had COVID and what now seems like long COVID symptoms. So, yeah, really interested, Matt, to see whether my Oura Ring shows that dip in 2022 and what it shows as for my health in the baseline period.
Thank you. That's great. So firstly, what does the Oura Ring measure? Well, it tracks well over 50 different health variables and statistics. So you've got things like for sleep, it measures your deep sleep, your REM sleep, and sleep latency. And that's the duration it takes for you to actually fall asleep once you're in bed. And in terms of health, it covers your heart rate, your body temperature, various fitness things like calories burnt, number of steps. It's almost like what doesn't it measure? It knows an awful lot about you. So that is obviously very useful in this this case. Now, this section looks at one of the key variables during that whole three-year baseline period, and it's sleep efficiency, and that is the proportion of time that you're in bed that you're actually asleep. And you can see for Amanda's data, you know, she obviously had a very healthy lifestyle, and that sleep efficiency is generally pretty stable, just around about the 90% mark. But there is a dive around about the middle of 2022. And as Amanda alluded to, that actually coincides with when she did have COVID, and that then became long COVID. She recovered. She had a hamstring injury at the same time and a cortisol injection, so she couldn't really exercise. So certainly we can see there that her sleep efficiency was lower during that period. And then when we look at deep sleep, now, deep sleep is a complex measure, but effectively based on your heart rate. And, you know, when your heart rate has a very large dip, your deep sleep scores basically over that period, three-year period. On the left, on the right, we zoom in actually to the last 6 months because Oura Ring actually recalibrated its deep sleep scores during that that later period. So we can sort of see that, again, it's fairly stable. The average, by the way, is the thick line. And then you can sort of see the daily variability, the up and down spikes over time. You can see there that the sleep took a decline there in the later part of 2023. The average has dropped, and there's lots of sort of spikes downwards, which is unusual. So certainly we think something was happening to the quality of her deep sleep during that time, which was pre-diagnosis. We can also look at things like average resting heart rate and exercise. So your average resting heart rate is impacted by a number of things. It tends to drift upwards in age, but it's impacted by your diet and exercise and all of those sorts of things. And interestingly, it does increase again during that period of inactivity with COVID. You can see on the left, you've got average resting heart rate, activities on the right. As activity goes down, average resting heart rate goes up, which is kind of the relationship that you expect to see. And that's a good check, I guess, that the stats and the analysis is kind of, you know, giving you some logical results. I will pass over again to Amanda, who's going to talk about her regime of monitoring stats.
Thank you. So the stats that Matt showed you for my baseline period are of no surprise to me because I am completely obsessed with my ring and I look at it every day. Every morning, it's the first thing that I do when I wake up. I know that's a little bit sad, but it's true. So just as an example of the sorts of things that I look at, when I wake up in the morning, I'm mostly interested in how well I slept the night before. So in the bottom left corner, you can see a sleep score of 85. That's kind of an overall measure of what my sleep was like. It was pretty good on that night. I got a crown, so that always makes me feel happy. The Oura Ring also shows how much time I've been in bed, what my resting heart rate was, and how much of the time in bed I was actually asleep for. And then over to the right, it breaks my sleep up into various stages. So for this particular night, my REM sleep, which is about halfway down in red, was a little bit lower than it normally is. So REM is when you do your dreaming. So for me, it comes up in red because I usually have a bit more REM sleep than that. But my deep sleep, which is another stage of sleep, which is more about recovery of the body and mind, that was pretty normal. So that's why it shows up in blue. So as I said, I check this every morning and look at my step count during the day via my phone. And in the 4 months leading up to my diagnosis, I didn't have any idea from the stats I was seeing from Oura that there was anything wrong. That's on a day-by-day basis. Although that is the period when the tumour would have started to grow, according to my oncologist. So, Matt, did the aura ring when you look at sort of a zoomed out basis of my stats, did it know something more than I did at that time?
Yes. So when we zoom out and we look at the baseline period and also the pre-diagnosis period, that was the 4 months, we can see there that the sleep efficiency, which is in red during that that pre-diagnosis period, actually the average doesn't really change that much. The sort of thick red line in the middle there. There are some dips, but we've seen some, you know, dips before. So there's nothing too interesting there. But what it is quite interesting is the deep sleep score. So you can see there that the average, which is the red line of the deep sleep score, seems to really reduce in those later months of 2024. And you can see there are quite a few spikes downwards. So while sleep efficiency itself wasn't really impacted that much, then again, that's time in bed, time asleep rather, as a percentage of your time in bed, you can see that the deep sleep is suffering somewhat. And that surprised us. And we wondered whether or not that was a sign of some impending health issues, which of course Amanda wasn't yet aware of. We also looked at other things, so average resting heart rate. Interestingly, the average resting heart rate drops in that pre-diagnosis period. You can see the average there reducing quite a lot. And that would normally be associated with a period of, you know, more fitness and, you know, more exercise. But in fact, the reverse is true. Step count is dropping, activity burn is dropping there. So interestingly, you know, we saw that inverse relationship before between the average resting heart rate and the level of activity. Well, that seems to have gone. We've now got more of a positive correlation between the two. And we don't really understand why that is, but something's happening to the average resting heart rate during that period. We also looked at a variety of different distributions and different variables to see if they changed pre-diagnosis versus the baseline period. And again, pre-diagnosis is the blue and the baseline is blue and pre-diagnosis is the red. And we've circled there the ones which are a little bit different. So things like, for example, sleep latency. I think that's on the bottom there. So sleep latency has actually improved. That's gone up. Restfulness score as well, you can see, has actually improved as well. Temperature trend on the top left there, that's sort of dropped a little bit. So I suppose that's a good thing. Temperature's sort of trending downwards, body temperature. But interestingly, activity score has gone up a little bit as well. But interestingly, it's deep sleep. So deep sleep score, which is the one you can see in the middle there, sort of bottom. Deep sleep seems to have reduced. So that is quite interesting. But is it statistically significant? Well, we had a look at that, and we had a look at the relationship between the mean and the distribution. So the mean you've got there on the x-axis, and the y-axis is your distribution. And we looked at what the p-value likelihood was, that the mean was statistically different and distribution was statistically different. Now, the data, that the dots that appear then in the bottom quadrant, they are the variables that have changed considerably in those 4 months leading up to diagnosis compared to the baseline. So you can see there are several health metrics there, such as, for example, deep sleep score, restfulness, sleep latency. So all of those seem to be statistically different in those 4 months. So we don't really understand why, but it's certainly interesting. So we're done with the pre-diagnosis phase, and Amanda is going to talk about what she endured during the chemotherapy phase.
Chemo, the fun part. As I said, chemo started for me a week after finding out that I had cancer, and chemo treatment and experiences will be very different for everyone who goes through it. For me, it involved 6 rounds or cycles every 3 weeks. And at the start of each round, I would go in for the day in hospital and be given a range of different drugs, 2 chemotherapy drugs and 2 targeted breast cancer drugs. And then I would take a range of different drugs throughout each 3 week cycle to combat any side effects that I felt. I tried to keep up my exercise as much as I could during chemotherapy. Some people might laugh at that, but generally that has been found to help you combat side effects of chemotherapy. But definitely my energy levels being so low on some days and really not feeling well meant that it was quite hard for me to keep up the same level of activity as I had pre-chemo, but I definitely did try. And one thing, like a pleasant surprise, was that the actual day of chemotherapy can be quite nice, or at least for me it was. I'm sure it's not the same for everyone. But it involved having a day with my husband sitting beside me all day. That never happens normally. I had a big comfy chair to sit on, could put lift my feet up, nurses all around feeding me and giving me nice cups of tea and looking after me. And I had an iPad so I could binge on Netflix. So it was actually, the day of chemo was pleasantly nice. The rest of chemo was not so nice. One thing, if we go on to the next slide, that I felt about my experience of chemotherapy was that being an actuary was actually really helpful. So I was able to, as an actuary, focus on numbers and facts as a way of sort of escaping emotions a little bit, I think. So this is a graph that one of the breast care nurses drew for me in my chemo education session, showing what my cell counts would likely be like throughout each three-week cycle. So she estimated, based on the average person, that by about day 7 to 10, I would probably be feeling my worst based on what my cells were doing. And then I would gradually pick up again by the end of each three-week cycle, ready to be struck down again by another wave of chemotherapy drugs. And for me, being able to focus on numbers and statistics like this just made my experience that little bit more bearable and a little bit more interesting. And I think it did that by giving me a way to emotionally detach from the experience. And that was my coping mechanism. And throughout this period, I tracked my stats with my Oura ring, but I also kept a diary just to keep track of what my energy levels were like on different days and side effects that I was experiencing. So, Matt, what did my Oura ring and diary have to say about the impact of chemo on my body?
Well, Amanda was very diligent about monitoring her energy score from day to day. You can see there that we have this sawtooth pattern. So for each new chemo round, which is a different colour, you can see the energy levels, they kind of they dive and then they gradually come back only to be replaced by another round of chemo. So it's almost exactly the same as what the nurse explained to Amanda. It's very interesting to see that sort of sawtooth pattern there. And when we look at the Oura ring data, the sleep efficiency, we also see same sort of thing. That's a sawtooth pattern. Sleep efficiency is dropping at the initial phases of chemo, and then it climbs back up, and you can see that, you know, big impact on sleep efficiency there. So certainly doesn't look very pleasant.
It wasn't.
No. And then in terms of when we look at the timeline, so the green, you've got the chemo period there, treatment period there on the green. And you can see sleep efficiency there has really taken a dive by about 10% on average during the chemo phase. And deep sleep as well. Deep sleep has dropped. It was already dropping even pre-diagnosis, and it's dropped again, the average, by quite a lot, but about sort of 10% on average. So you can see the chemo's had a big impact on sleep, and that's very much to be expected in terms of, you know, impacts of the drugs themselves. There's obviously, you know, increased anxiety. There is pain and discomfort and hormone changes, which all would impact your deep sleep. Also looked at average resting heart rate, and weirdly that had dropped during the pre-diagnosis phase. And that's really risen considerably during the treatment phase. Activity burn actually isn't that much changed. It's sort of a little bit, it's sort of very similar, but the average resting heart rate has gone right up. And that's due to the impact there of the chemo. So we're done. We're on to the post-chemo phase now. Pass back to Amanda.
Woohoo! I was very happy when I had my last round of chemo. I went out with friends to celebrate that night, even though I was already starting to feel unwell again. But having chemo behind me meant that I could start to look forward to feeling better again, even though I did have to have a couple of surgeries after chemo was finished. Once it had finished, I had a surgery in August and then another one in February this year. And then I had some sort of fallout from that surgery, I guess, just in terms of typical pain at the site of surgery, some soreness and stiffness in my joints and muscles. But generally now I feel pretty much back to normal. Not in every aspect, but generally I'm feeling pretty good again, which is great. So let's have a final look at my aura stats to see what my readings did during that period when I was starting to feel better.
Well, during the recovery period, we've added that in orange, and you can see there that the sleep efficiency is once again increasing, you know, much towards the baseline level, and deep sleep score is also increasing. It's not back at the sort of the original baseline level, but it's certainly recovering very nicely without the impact of the chemotherapy drugs. Also, average resting heart rate is back down to similar levels. It's even dipped a little bit below where we saw it in the pre-baseline period. And activity burn is also increasing as well following the chemotherapy. So that is great to see. So change tack slightly. A little bit of an update then on the sleep efficiency predictor model and how we did that. So we looked at a whole range of variables actually that impact sleep. And some of those are directly controllable, things like your step count and amount of sun you get and all that sort of thing. Some of them are not really particularly indirectly controllable. Can't do much about the previous night's sleep that you had. That's all done. And within the directly controllable stuff, there's some data that is just not available. We would have loved to have it, things like your alcohol intake and your stress at work and other things. So we would love to have that. But as we know, that those have a huge impact on sleep. We updated our efficiency model, and it's a linear regression model, lasso regression. And what it does, it performs the regularization and the feature selection, adds penalty to certain variables that are not particularly predictive. And as it's a time series analysis, you know, we also time shifted many of them to look at what the impact was, because obviously your sleep and your activity levels in previous days are also important to your sleep tonight. So we did that. And the usual cross-validation. So we looked at, we had a test data set and, an original training set, which was 75% of the data that was based on the pre-diagnosis element. And then we tested it forward after that, which is about 25% of the data set. And there is more detail in the paper. There's a more detailed slide pack available for those that are interested in the study. But suffice to say, what are we actually tracking? Well, it's a whole bunch of those variables to do with sleep efficiency, heart rate, body temperature and movement and those sort of things. And, you know, we also added some external variables that we had access to, like the phases of the moon and rainfall and all those sort of things. I think if we could have an impact on sleep. And sleep efficiency is actually the response variable that we're trying to measure. And you can see the distribution there on the left-hand side. And again, that's the history over time, how it moved with the various phases of treatment and so on. So I probably won't go too much into the details of the model, but you're welcome to read about some of the things we had to do to kind of standardize the data and, cope with multicollinearity and those sorts of things. I'll leave you to read that. So in terms of predictions, we've got here variables which are in red and blue. Now, red is the stuff that you have some control over, like, you know, whether you move every hour or your number of steps and training frequency and those sort of things. And then the blue things are things that are not directly controllable or they take some time. Like, you know, you have a sleep bank that builds up over time that you can't really change in the short term. So a lot of the things that the most predictive variables on the left, they're the things that you can't necessarily change instantly. But the red ones are interesting. They are things that do predict our sleep quality. And they are things like your activity score, how cool you are at night. Temperature, not like how cool you are. Your inactivity time, rest time, that sort of thing, and whether you move every hour. So there are certainly things that you certainly can change. But what it shows, that the stuff on the left-hand side shows you that there are some things you can't suddenly change instantly. You can't have a whole week of late dinners and suddenly then, you know, expect to have a really good sleep by not having a late dinner. Using late dinner, obviously, as a euphemism for excessive alcohol consumption. So there's certain things you can do quickly, certain things you can't do quickly, but you can certainly predict, you can certainly influence your sleep. We also looked at the performance of the model across different phases. So we got an R squared of 0.17 for the before chemo, which is, you know, it's got some predictive value. You'd normally hope for a range of, you know, 0.2 to 0.5 in this kind of study that's got, that has this kind of data, but we got that. During chemo, the model completely breaks down, so it goes negative. So it's worse than random. And it's got some predictive power after chemo as well. And when you look at the dotted line, that's where the dot should be. You've got the blue, which is your training data set, pre-diagnosis, which is reasonable fit. The black is actually after chemo, which is a sort of okay fit, but it's the red data, which is during chemo, where, you know, the model sort of completely breaks down. You can't really, you know, you can't really use a model for that. So there's a lot we don't know still about sleep efficiency, and lots of variables we would like to know about. So in terms of key findings, again, we found very limited studies on early detection of cancer. But wouldn't it be amazing if we could actually determine from wearable data that there's a need for someone to get a checkup? So Amanda was advised by her GP and there was a family history, but what about someone that doesn't have you know, those characteristics? We certainly found some things that we couldn't explain, like the flipping of the relationship between average heart rate and activity, but also deep sleep. Deep sleep seemed to really suffer during that that pre-diagnosis period, and even towards the end, really, of that baseline, towards the end of 2024. So I think something happening there, you know, in the body, potentially in terms of affecting your deep sleep. We also found there are several controllable factors as well that can improve your sleep, but it takes time. You can't suddenly go from having terrible sleep and lifestyle to suddenly sorting your sleep out. And also we realized that you can get some quite powerful insights from a zoomed out view. You can't just look at your app or your wearable device and see exactly what's happening. You actually do need to sort of download this data and take a better view. I think it'd be good to get some more information on things like that we know are, you know, very sleep predictive, like alcohol content and stress and those sort of things. But yeah, that's where we got to with the analysis. And Amanda, your thoughts?
I guess as actuaries, we work with data just about every day. And hopefully this is a reminder that there is almost always at least one or more humans behind that data. For this particular human, one of my key takeaways from my cancer experience was the importance of the community that I have around me. I have so many, I'm very, very lucky to have so many loving and kind friends that really looked after me. I had access to amazing medical staff in the nurses and doctors who treated me. And my workplace, the Actuaries Institute, I think it was about a day after I told Mike and Janice that I had breast cancer, that they'd taken all the stress out of my workload with Elaine's approval and just gave me meaningful tasks that were not stressful though. So I'm forever grateful for that. And thank you very much to Matt and his team of data science actuaries for agreeing to share this journey with me. I would like to finish this story by saying that I am now breast cancer free and I'm ready to get on with my life again. So thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, both of you. That was really amazing. Okay, we've got time for questions. I haven't got any coming through in the app, so please feel free to stand up and ask a question in real life. I've got a quick one to kick us off, maybe more for you, Matt, but how quickly do you think, you know, the likes of Oura Ring or even Apple Watch will be sending us those early warning signals saying, you know, there's been a change in your deep sleep, go and get a checkup or something like that?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So, that's a good question. So, I mean, Apple Watch, I wear an Apple Watch and it often tells me annoying things like that my sleep is worse or that my average weight has increased, whether I want it to or not. Question is whether we can use that for something that's, you know, of real benefit. I think there is something there. I think if you look at something like Oura Ring, if we did have a study of people that were where we had their data pre-diagnosis and during, you know, after diagnosis and treatment, like Amanda. Do you think there's something there we could do? There's something spooky going on with the deep sleep there. And you would think it would, you know, if something's growing in your body, you would think that it would certainly, you know, impact your sleep. So I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's too far-fetched.
Yeah, at the back there. I do remember from menopause, deep sleep dives as well. So it might be menopause. You might have cancer. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Nicolette. And Amanda, firstly, thank you very much for sharing something so personal. I think we all appreciate that. So I'll not go to the personal in my questions so much. But Matt, thanks for the analysis as well. I'm interested in how much, if you can talk about it, your healthcare professionals cared about this information that you were accumulating. And then I'm interested probably from both of you in what we, when we work for insurers, should do or could do with this type of information, at which points, you know, underwriting, helping people with their own personal health, et cetera?
That's a really good question. I told my oncologist that I was giving this presentation and she may end up watching, so I'll be careful about what I say. She was really amazing and I have her to thank for my life. Yeah, I don't know if I think I mentioned that I was tracking my health via my Oura Ring. I don't know how interested she was. And another observation from a few years back when I was worried about my son and I suspected he wasn't getting much good sleep, we actually put a monitor on him at that time, and I took that data in to show the paediatrician. And she was very dismissive of the data because it hadn't been collected by another medical professional. She said she couldn't even tell what was on the y-axis. And to be honest, I couldn't give her the answer to that. But yeah, I have found in general that a lot of the doctors that I see and over the last year, I'm not sure how interested they were in data that's not collected by their peers.
Thank you. Well, yeah, I'll answer from a life insurance perspective, because if you think about all the wearable data, potentially it's problematic because it's just another version of the asymmetry that we've already got. Things like genetic testing now, we've made some headway on that, and we're not going to be using adverse genetic tests in life insurance. But then there's another asymmetry of data, you know, where people have knowledge of their health, and the more advanced these wearables get. So that's something we have to think about very carefully. But set against that, you have the situation that the life insurance market in Australia has to evolve. You'd have to find new ways of underwriting people and to go for new markets, right? Younger people, people who don't have a financial advisor. So the technology aspect of underwriting is incredibly important. I'm just not sure how we quite get around the ethical risks. So yeah, to be continued, I think.
I did find out during my cancer journey that I have the BRCA2 gene mutation, and it did make me think about how lucky I was that I could get that test without really even thinking about the implications if I wanted to take out life insurance. But it did make me realise how someone could be put off getting that testing if they knew it would be used against them, and how detrimental that could be, because I made some medical decisions based on that result, which was really important for my health, I think.
Yeah, do you want to go to the mic? Thanks. Just while you go, I actually went with my Oura Ring data, and I told my GP that on this certain medication, I thought my heart rate had gone up. And the GP's reaction was really a bit dismissive around the reliability of the wearables and the quality of the data.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Katja. I'm an associate professor at UNSW. I do research on healthy aging, and we look at wearables for aging, measuring well-being and aging. And it's interesting how phones can pick up patterns in your speech, and it can be early signs of dementia, or it can be signs of depression. And so there's really, I look forward to more analytics that you may do on the aging space, where identifying such large potential impediments to our well-being early can have huge impact on a person's well-being. So keep up the good work. It's very exciting.
Yeah, looks like a bit of an academic opportunity there. Elaine?
So obviously, huge thank you for bringing your personal stories. Like, I mean, I love the way the world has evolved for a more genuine conversation between people and the personal. So thank you very much. I guess my question is around the on your studies. Who are the kind of people who love wearing these rings and gathering the information, and who? So my husband wears it. He loves it. I'm a bit terrified about finding that information. I wonder, is there any information you can share on the kind of people who love this data and those that...
Well, I would have thought actuaries would love this. I was surprised how few people in the room. Just a hands up, who wears an Apple Watch? So there's lots of Apple Watches, but not Aura rings.
I'll wear both. You
I'll say one thing. So actuaries, yes. It's amazing the number of people, if you're into running, the number of people who wear these devices, as I do. If you look at running and you look at how your average heart rate is trending, and look at your heart rate variability, and Apple tells you to rest this day, and you say, thank you for the suggestion, I'm not going to do it. So people who are into that sort of stuff.
Actually, so as an underwriter, we should just test, do you have one and use one, not even what the results on the thing are.
There's a lot of self-selection in there, yes. Firstly, congratulations. I noticed your heart rate's really good, the resting heart rate. I've been working really hard myself, but I think the alcohol takes it up all. I had a question for Matt, because I've been working with the Life Insurance Practice Committee. I'm about to, actually, on how do we expand the number of jobs for actuaries. And one of the ideas randomly came to my mind was, let's focus on the living as opposed to the dead, which part of that is aura and other things. How do you see this coming up as a real creator of actuarial opportunities globally?
Good question. I mean, it's no secret that life insurance market is incredibly challenged in Australia for a number of reasons, profitability, efficiency-wise. And that's why we've decided to branch out much more at MNC into other fields, right, like data science. And analyzing the living, right? And I think it's an amazing opportunity. So I'd say to people, just go and find an idea and go and study it and go and get the data and let's present and let's discuss it, because there's so much there that actuaries can do. You just got to go and find the opportunities.
Oh, just a thought that comes to mind is that it's probably not just something for the actuarial profession to think about. I remember listening to something about the way that our medical model works, and basically you go and see a doctor if you're sick. If you present to a doctor as a healthy person and say you want to get some blood tests just so you've got a baseline, or then it's actually quite hard to do and may not even be funded by Medicare. So there is that mind shift from focusing on the bad stuff to trying to maintain health.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, last question. Thank you.
Thanks so much for sharing, Amanda, and Matt as well, for a fascinating presentation. Amanda, does your husband wear one? Because it'd be great to see the data. Maybe another follow-up presentation on, did he have sympathetic symptoms? You know, you hear about pregnancies.
Oh, that's such a great question, Martha. Yes, he wears one. He bought this one for me, and he's been wearing his for about a year or two more than me, I think. And often when I have a bad sleep, the first thing I do is go and check his score to see if he was the one waking me up or the other way around. So that would be a really interesting follow-up. Thanks.
We've actually got them on our whole family. Our kids have got them too. Mine's not on because I get too obsessive. I have to have a break from it. So it was really interesting hearing Amanda put her results up and say, and it's a worry. The first thing when you wake up in the morning is you look at your results and you decide on how good your sleep was depending on what you see. So, okay, now with that, I think we're on time. But please, can you thank Amanda and Matt